This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lafife, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of all people are needed to make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak on bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 9 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can log into our website, thepeoplespeakradio.com, to join us live, listen to archives of previous shows, or join us in our live chat room on Pal Talk. You can listen by phone, dial 760-569-7676, enter access code 192919 pound when prompted, or on your computer or smartphone, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to station 2, and click the listen icon. The People Speak invites audience participation. If you have questions and comments for our guest or topic during the show, please call toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Tonight, my guest is Ellen Brown, president of the Public Banking Institute, attorney and writer. Ellen's newest book, and a very good one, I might add, The Public Bank Solution, was released in June and covers in amazing depth a topic that's at the front of everyone's minds, our governments and the news. Is the economic troubles of our nation, the world, how we got there, and what we can do about it. Good evening, Ellen.
Hi, Jeanette.
Ellen, when I first received your book, I admit I was pretty overwhelmed because banking and economics and monetary systems, and I'm just an ordinary person trying to get through day to day, and it seemed rather daunting. And as I mentioned earlier, I skimmed the chapters, and you touched a lot on the history of the systems, how we got here, and I'd like to start there if we could, the evolution of monetary and economic systems to where we are now. I know that's a lot to bite off, but give it a shot.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to hear you thought it was daunting. I was trying to make it quite as simple as I could. That's what I do. Is try to make things that other people think are obscure, and they think, that's too much for me. I'm not going to understand that, so I'll leave it to the experts. Well, we're learning that the experts can't be trusted. In fact, that they've made this stuff purposely difficult so that we won't look too closely, because basically it's a fraud. Our entire money, the scheme that by which our money comes into existence is based on a fraud, but it's an effective fraud. The part that's bad about it seems to me, is that it's privately owned, and therefore you have private bankers pretending to create our money supply, or pretending to lend money they already have, when in fact they create it on their books, but they keep the profits. So if we just acknowledge that money is created by banks, it's basically spendable IOUs, as somebody said, it's you yourself actually create the money when you go to the bank and turn your mortgage or other promissory note into a loan that becomes numbers in your checkbook that you're then able to write checks to other people. You pay out this money. So you don't actually create dollar bills, but you create money in the form of checkbook money that then goes into other banks, and they count it as deposits that they can then write checks against. And so that's the way the system works. It started, if you go, I went back to Sumeria, which is about 3000 BC, and most people think that the original money, or the longest, most stable money, is gold, and that it's been the longest in, you know, continuous use in different civilizations, but that's not actually true. The oldest systems and the most stable and longest lived systems are public systems, which is hard to believe. I mean, it's hard to know how these came into existence, because the whole Sumerian civilization effectively began with Samaria, and it just popped out of nowhere. They had the first writing, the first math, the first roads and bridges, and all these very sophisticated things just appeared, and then, of course, the Egyptians were right after them with the same sort of thing, and the Egyptians had the same sort of publicly owned banking system. So really what it was originally was just an accounting system. For the Sumerians, they kept track of things with little cuneiform writing. It was, you know, little marks chipped in stone, and that's where they kept track of who owed what to whom. So the money itself was really the thing being traded. So you cows could be money, or wheat, or corn. I mean, you just kept track of quantities of those different things, and they were valued against each other. And the banker, or what served the function of banking in Sumeria, in the older ancient Sumeria, was the temple. It was a religious society built around a temple. There was a goddess, Inanna, who was the goddess, and people would pay tithes to the temple originally in the form of, you know, just the products that they had. But there were also loans that were made, particularly to traveling salesmen who would take whatever products they had and go off into other areas. And they would pay interest when they came back with, like, they would take some wares and they would come back with something else, silver or whatever, and they would pay interest on that, and the interest would go to the temple. But the temple used it for public purposes, so it was really what we would now call a public banking system, a publicly owned bank that was there to serve the people, and the profits went back to the people. So that evolved into a different system, the private usury-based, interest-based, debt-based system. Now,
can I interject here, because I want to clarify something. From what I'm understanding here, the original banks, public banks, are backed by some form of tangible value, whether it be the property of the state or the labor and production of the people, but there's something supporting it, and that's not really true of our system now. Or am I misunderstanding something here?
That's true. They didn't have anything like derivatives, or they didn't even have abstract numbers. So they had a figure for 10 sheep and a figure for 1 sheep, but they didn't have a figure for 10 times 10 equals 100, that type of thing. But even today, in a real public system, you're turning something tangible into money. I mean, well, even what a bank does, they turn your mortgage into money, or they turn your promise to pay into money. And then if it were a public system, let's say governments actually issued the money, they would be paying for things. So the way the money would get into the system, it's really just a receipt acknowledging that you gave me something of value, and all I gave you was an IOU, a little piece of paper that you didn't necessarily want, the thing that I had. So we in the system, we the community, have agreed to accept this little piece of paper because you have done some service for the community. Let's say it's the government that originally pays you for, say it's the military. That's how our paper money first came into existence in 1691, when Massachusetts, that the governor of Massachusetts was fighting a little war, and he didn't have any gold or silver to pay his soldiers with, and he couldn't find anybody to borrow from. So he just printed out these little IOUs, basically, and paid them in IOUs. And then everybody accepted that they had done a service for the community, and these IOUs were acceptable in the payment of taxes. So everybody accepted them and used them, and they circulated in the community. And that's where our money, how our money system evolved. So it really was backed by something. It was backed by the services of the soldiers, or if you paid for crops or materials or labor that's paid to the government. In fact, that system an earlier system based on that same model, which was a public system, was the tally system of England. And there, the tallies were, the people already owed taxes. So the tally was just really an advance payment against taxes. So it wasn't really that the king owed the person who paid something to the king. It was that the person already owed to the king, and this was evidence that he had paid, and so he didn't have to pay later.
Okay, so now I understand that early in the U.S. history, we had several experiments with public banks, and they came to an end. Can we address the early history of banking within the USA, the first banks, and when and how the private banks took over?
Mm-hmm. Well, before we were the USA, there was probably the best of the colonial banking models was in Pennsylvania, and the Pennsylvania colonists had their own public bank, which some of the colonies just, or most of the colonies, just printed this paper script, and it was a bit easy. It was easier to print it than to collect it back in the form of taxes. So they had a tendency to print too much, and that would dilute the value of the currency. But in Pennsylvania, instead of just printing and spending it, they printed it and lent it, so the money came back to the public bank, or back to the provincial government. And then beyond that, they could print some money and spend it on what the government needed. So there was always enough money out there to pay principal and interest. So you didn't have this exponential growth of debt like we have today, where banks create the principal, but they don't create the interest. And so there's never enough money out there to pay all of the debts, all of the principal plus interest. Either somebody has to go bankrupt, or somebody has to take out yet another loan, creating yet more debt money in the system. But in the colonial system, it was a sustainable closed system where you actually did get the interest back. The people themselves got it back in the form of their government, which then would spend it into the local economy. So it was there, available, to pay principal and interest on these debts. But then if you're talking about after the U.S. was actually formed, we had the first U.S. bank and the second U.S. bank, which are very controversial, and they did wound up getting privatized, or largely private, so, you know, portions sold off to investors. But they did serve a very useful function. They did something that in Europe was just unheard of, which was they extended credit. So they extended the credit of the government to build and fund all sorts of productivity, and the economy actually did very well during that period. But it was controversial because it was privatized. Part of it was privatized, and there was concern that there were foreign owners and so forth. And so both those banks, their charters weren't renewed, and then we went into this period of wildcat banking where banks were creating their own, private banks were creating their own banknotes. And so you had all these banks, supposedly the banknotes were backed by gold, and they were just a little receipt acknowledging that the bank was holding your gold, and here's a little receipt that was more convenient to trade in the economy. But they also discovered that they could lend up to 10 times as many of these little notes as they had gold. And so that's what they tended to do, and they would get caught periodically and not having enough gold whenever there was a bank run. And so you had these periodic waves of inflation and depression where there'd be not enough money, and then the economy would shrink and people would be out of work. And so it was not a stable system. And then we went to, I don't know how much of this evolution you want me to go into, but then we went into, Lincoln went back to the system of the American colonists, where he actually issued government-issued money to pay for the war, not the Civil War, not the whole war, but he supplemented the money he had so that he wouldn't have to borrow at these quite high interest rates from the Wall Street and British bankers. and that worked very well. But of course, he was assassinated. And then we had the National Bank Act, which gave private banks the power to issue. They were still issuing their own banknotes, but they were supposedly U.S. dollars. I mean, they were, because they were in the federal system, so they were all recognized as money. And then they had the federal system backstopping them. And then, but then, I'm not sure how much you want me to keep going on this, but...
One of the things I do hear a lot about, so I understand that it was Lincoln tried to reform things and was assassinated. We went back into the private banking, but there was a movement, the populist movement, that thought that they had achieved a public banking system by demanding the Federal Reserve. So maybe we could kind of jump forward there, because my understanding is the Federal Reserve is a big part of the reason we are where we are now.
It was another one of those, it was so obscurely, the Federal Reserve Act was so obscurely written that you couldn't really tell what it said. It was William Jennings Bryan was the leader of the populist movement, and he was he ran for president as on a third-party ticket the first time, and then on the Democratic ticket the second time. And or maybe it was Democratic both times, I'm forgetting. And he lost, but he had a huge popular following, and that was as close as we ever got to having a third party in power. So after he lost, he was still in Congress, and he led the opposition to the Federal Reserve Act, and which originally was called the Aldrich Act, and it was quite obvious what it was, that Aldrich was a big Wall Street man, and he said no way was he going to... would he approve a system in which our money was created privately by bankers and lent to us. So they changed the name of it. They called it the Federal Reserve Act, and they changed the wording and made it look like it would be a public bank that would be issuing the money on behalf of the public. And so William Jennings Bryan himself supported it and said, at last, we the people were going to have our own money, issuing our own money. But that wasn't what it was. What it was the Federal Reserve is composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. And the Federal Reserve, though it does issue the money, it lends it to the government. It's not like it is the government and just spends it for things that people need. So it's still a debt-based system, and as it was originally set up, the money was lent at interest to the government. So the Federal Reserve was getting paid interest for money that it printed, and just for the cost of paper, and was giving that to the government at interest. Then later, the rules were changed so that the Fed couldn't lend directly to the government. It had to buy government bonds on the open market. That was supposed to slow the government up from printing bonds, but it didn't actually. And then later yet, the rules were changed so that the Fed had to rebate its profits back to the government. So what we have is a little more, less fraudulent than what we had in 1913, but it's still, the Fed calls itself an independent central bank, which supposedly means independent of government, and it is independent of government, but it's not independent. It's actually controlled by the banks that own those 12 Federal Reserve branches, and it does what the bankers want. You could see that particularly in this last bailout in 2008. The system collapsed because of rampant banker fraud. I mean, it was all these mortgage-backed securities that were sold as AAA when they were actually subprime, and pretender lending and so forth. All the fraud that was involved in the securitization of mortgages. And instead of just letting the banks collapse and say, well, you were engaging in fraud and it didn't work out for you, you're bankrupt, and letting them fold, the Federal Reserve rushed in and bailed them out with money that was just created on a screen. I mean, there was one facility after another, these lending facilities. that they were buying all this junk mortgages off the books of the banks, letting them off the hook for frauds that they got stuck with. And so the Fed wound up with the junk mortgages, and the banks got fresh dollars to start all over again.
Okay, now, we're going to have to take a break in here in just a few minutes, but something I do want to cover here, because when we talk about public banks, of course, in the USA, the capitalist, public banks, socialism, can we define the difference between the public banking system operating in the people's interests and that specter of demon communism they use every time we try to bring something like this up?
Well, there are 50% of the U.S. 50% of the economy is actually government-owned. There's the public sector and the private sector. Some things belong in the public sector and some things belong in the private sector. We have roads, for example, that are in the public sector, but we don't consider ourselves a socialist or a communist country just because the government owns the roads or funds the building of the roads. We have many things that the government owns and the government funds, and it's just a question of what you put in the public sector. So a public bank, first of all, we only have one public bank, and that's in North Dakota, and it's the Bank of North Dakota, which is sort of like a mini-Fed for the state. All the other banks are private. The Bank of North Dakota is not competing with those private banks. It helps those private banks. It's partnering with them, just as the Federal Reserve partners with the banks that are members of the Federal Reserve. It helps those banks. But in the Bank of North Dakota, it actually is publicly owned. It actually does serve the public. The profits go back to the public. And, you know, it just has a different mandate than our Federal Reserve does.
Okay. Now, after we get back from the break, I usually take questions during the second half of the show, and I've got an amazing number stacking up. A lot of people have questions for you tonight, Ellen. And for those listening, I have read Ellen's book, The Public Bank Solution. It is extremely well written. When I said early on that initially I was intimidated, I did want to go on to say that after having read it, that this was one of the better books I have ever read. I rarely really push books, but it did clarify a lot of things I didn't understand. Big words like quantitative easing and, you know, the things they intimidate us into sitting down and shutting up with. So we will we'll take a break right here. We will be back. This is the People Speak Radio, broadcasting live on BBS.com Internet Radio.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Welcome back to The People Speak, live on BBS.com Internet Radio. Again, I'm Jeanette LaFevre with our guest Ellen Brown, discussing her most recently published book, The Public Bank Solution. During this portion of the show, you can call in questions and comments for our guest toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Welcome back, Helen. Or Ellen, I'm sorry. And as I promised, I'm sitting here looking at questions stacking up, so I think we need to get right into this. I'm going to start with Ted in Canada. There are rumors the U.S. dollar may be replaced as reserve currency. Could you walk us through the impact if the petrodollar dies? Now, I have to be real honest. I'm not real sure what the importance of reserve currency is either. So go ahead.
Well, I think that that whole argument is overblown, and that whole concern. First of all, we would be better off if we weren't the world's reserve currency. That's the reason we are always having to. We wind up buying more imports than exports, because they need our money, and so we're always basically short of money. The oil basis of the dollar has collapsed. China and many countries now buy their oil in something other than dollars, and it hasn't hurt us. The dollar is just not going down unless we do something totally stupid like impose a debt ceiling on ourselves. We have the power to create dollars. We have the power to, even if, you know, let's say the Chinese sell their bonds. Let's say everybody sells their bonds. Fine. Our Federal Reserve has the power to buy those bonds. And that's where I think the bonds, who should buy the bonds? In other words, our central bank should have funded our bonds in the first place. And then we, the people, would get the interest back and we would have a sustainable system.
Okay. So I think I got that one. Now, from Mike in California, Ellen, I'm not too smart on economics, but I'm for anything, including your public bank solution, if it can help the USA. How do we make this a reality in every state?
Well, we're working on that now. I'm president of the Public Banking Institute, and we have groups in, well, let me give the website first, publicbankinginstitute.org. So there's a lot of information there on how to set up a public bank, how to approach your legislators. We could do city-owned banks, county-owned banks. We have a lot of hope for those local banks right now. The more local you get, first of all, they're more approachable. There are fewer legislators that you have to persuade, and they are actually quite desperate. Like there are counties in Pennsylvania that are. They're quite broke, and they don't have the power to create money like the Federal Reserve does. So they're just stuck with what they can get in taxes. Their tax base has totally fallen off because of this banking crisis, which has wound up in people being laid off, and they're not paying their taxes anymore. The housing market collapsed, so you don't get as much in real estate taxes, et cetera. So they're actively looking for solutions, and they're quite open to these solutions. So the options are either to persuade your legislators to do it, and I've written in Public Bank Solution, I have several chapters on the details of how you would actually go about setting up a bank. It would actually be very quick. You could set up a bank in a few days if you had a motivated legislature that decided they wanted to pull their money out of Wall Street and they wanted to set up their own bank. They could just buy one. There are banks for sale that already have. There are a lot of banks, you know, that are going under these days. So buy one that you've already got the charter. You've already got, if you want a building, you've got building and workers and everything you need right there.
Okay, I may mention here, I live in Michigan. So some of this I'm seeing firsthand, particularly Detroit and the impact of the system we have on a city's finance, a major city, and what's going on there. And in fact, I don't know if you're familiar with Kevin Orr, the emergency manager there, but one of the things he said quite plainly, I'm not sure if he'll follow through on it, is that the investors in Detroit, the people who loaned Detroit money, were in the business of risk management, and they continued making loans knowing that Detroit was in trouble. And at this point, in his opinion, the bondholders are going to have to settle for cents on the dollar, because unlike the pension holders, they were in the business of taking risks.
Well, I actually read an article on that, and there are bondholders which make actual loans, but besides that, there were banks, Bank of America, UBS, and SBS, that had engaged in interest rate swaps with the city, which is just sheer and utter gambling. I mean, that's called risk management, but what it is gambling, and they don't tell you that it's really a bet and that you're on the other side of the bet. I mean, that they're your opponent in this bet, and they're selling you the goods. And what they don't tell you is that they say you're protecting your interest rate from it going up. But what they don't tell you is that if it goes down, you're going to owe them, and you're going to owe them a lot of money. And they actually were paid off right before the bankruptcy. And the reason they could get away with that was because of the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005 says that derivatives claimants go first in bankruptcy, super priority, which is horrible. It should be the pensioners who go first, but they managed to get that in. It was the big bankers who leaned on Congress and got them to write it that way to nurture their fledgling derivatives business, which is now like $250 billion or so.
Okay, I'm going to, at this point, I'm going to go back to call-ins and questions from the listeners. From Tom in Ohio, Ellen, have you seen Bill Still's latest film called Jekyll Island, and do you have any disagreements with the solutions he lays out in his films?
I have seen it, actually. He's a friend. And what I disagree with, I guess, I mean, in general, I think it definitely would be good for the government to issue the money. That's where the money should be coming from. That's where it did come from in colonial times. We should have stuck with that system. It was a brilliant American invention, and we could solve our problems that way. It's funny. I do feel that I disagree with some things, but I can't remember what. Anyway, basically, I agree with them.
Okay, now from Ron in Indiana, and given what's happening today in our government, this may be more relevant. Are there any countries currently who are using their own independent currencies and succeeding? And is that related to the reason that Gaddafi was overthrown in Libya and killed?
Precisely. Libya was issuing their own money. They owned their own bank. They were very wealthy, and I mean, partly it was oil, but they owned their banks, which they were state-owned banks, and so they could issue the money they needed for social benefits. They had amazing social benefits: free health care, free higher education. They gave $50,000 to young couples when they got married, and they could afford all that because they were the bankers, so they could. They could issue the credit as needed. In fact, they were funding an Africa-wide program that was it was like the Africa Monetary Fund, and that most of the money was put in by Gaddafi.
Okay, now does Syria also have its own currency and own bank, or is this related, or is this
They all do. That's the thing. They all have state-owned banks. There's Syria. Libya, Iran, and Iraq are the four that are the big ones, and then there are several others. I can't remember Somalia. Those Muslim countries, you could argue that the reason they're being targeted is that they have an alternative banking model that is totally diametrically opposed to, usury is considered not just a sin, but a crime in Islamic countries, and which means lending money at interest. Now, they actually, their banking models, I don't think they've really solved the problem of how to do that. They just came up with the first, Islamic banking only originated in the 70s, and what they have is sort of, it's been called usury by another name. But if you have a public bank, if you have public banks and the interest returns to the public, then you do have a sustainable system, and you don't need derivatives, you own the banks, you don't have to worry about that whole, the derivatives are far bigger than interest now as a moneymaker for Western banks, and you just don't need them if you have a public banking system.
Okay, let me go back to this next question here. It was in relation to the assassination of John F. Kennedy from even Las Vegas. What are the odds, according to your belief, that he was killed in part due to his executive order 11110 dealing with the issuance of our currency independent of the Federal Reserve? And I've heard this before, and I'm not familiar with it. So
yeah, well, that bill wasn't a bill. It was a problem. It was controversial because really what all it said was that he was delegating to the treasurer the power to issue U.S. notes or the things that were, they actually went back to the Civil War and they had been issued before. So he wasn't doing anything terribly unique. And it was rumored that he was planning to issue a lot of U.S. notes, but he was assassinated before he did it, so you can't really prove that. And he alienated so many other groups that it's not clear which. I mean, he took on everybody, the CIA and the mafia, and so it's not clear who actually got him. But I think definitely the fact that he pitted himself against the Federal Reserve was not a safe thing to do.
Okay. Ellen, our next one is a caller on the line, Rock from Dearborn, I believe it is.
Do you see a major financial meltdown and the nation going bankrupt to where the nation would have to default on its credit?
No, I don't. The nation can't default on its credit unless, as I say, it just stupidly imposes a debt ceiling on itself, because the Federal Reserve has the power to create money, and it right now is buying up. It's got like $2 trillion worth of our debt. Where did it get the money? It just created it on its books. So it could create $16 trillion on its books and buy up the whole debt. So we're not going to default. What I think the next crisis is going to be, since we have all this bail-in stuff going on where the banks are being required to come up with these living wills where they say what they're going to do in the event of another big, if they go bankrupt and the government won't bail them out, because under Dodd-Frank, the government has said, we're not going to bail you out from a big derivatives collapse or bust. We're going to let you play with the derivatives, but we're not going to help out if it goes bad. So the banks have come up with, they're guided or instructed by the Financial Stability Board, which is in Europe, and which is the global regulator now, which has told them that they have to come up with these bail-in plans where they will basically confiscate depositor funds in order to recapitalize the banks. So they'll turn your money into capital or stock of their bank, and all you'll have is a piece of stock that you're not going to be able to pay your mortgage with it. So when that happens, historically, like in Argentina and other places, when people go to the bank and they can't get their money, that is when the system changes. And I think it's not unlikely that that will happen with a big bank, like most likely Bank of America or J.P. Morgan, because they're the big derivatives holders. They've both got over $1 trillion in deposits and over $70 trillion in derivatives that could easily go bad. So I think that would be the next shakeup.
Wouldn't that be a part of their cashless society venture that they're going on?
A cashless society, to me, doesn't seem all that threatening either. I mean, it is pretty much cashless. We're just using our credit cards, right? It's numbers in the What about Bitcoin? That's cashless, and yet there's much to be said for it. Or even your basic online community currency would be cashless, but it's not inherently bad. What would be bad is if some bad element, some mafia type, gets control of the system and is able to shut you out from your from those numbers that represent what you have a claim to.
Okay, Ellen. Before we go to the, can I interject here, Rock? Because during the course of your questioning, she's mentioned creating money several times, and we're always told creating money is bad. Creating money is inflationary. Could you tell us why we're wrong?
Well, all of our money is created. So if the banks didn't create any money, we wouldn't have any money in the system. Or if the government didn't create any money, let's say you start from zero. We don't use gold anymore. There's nothing. We're not trading anything tangible. So let's say you start from zero and you require people to pay taxes. What are they going to pay it with? You've got to print some money first and get it out there so they can return it to you. The way banks create money is that when you go to take out a loan, they do it by double entry bookkeeping, where they enter your mortgage on one side of the book as an asset to themselves because you're going to pay that over time with interest, and they enter it on the other side of their books as a liability to themselves because they're going to write that number into an account, and you are then probably going to write a check to your seller if you're buying a house, and then that check will go into another bank, and when it does, the first bank has to clear the check, so they're liable at that point. But they clear it by borrowing it from somewhere else. So either they borrow it from their other depositors, ideally, because that's the cheapest place they can get it, or they borrow it from the Fed funds, which are the deposits of other banks, which are now the Fed funds rate is 0.25%, so it's very, very low. Or if they have to, they borrow from the Federal Reserve itself, which is 0.75%, which is still very low. So they get money very cheaply, and they lend it on at a much higher interest rate. But that is where our money comes from, and if we didn't have that money out there, in fact, we don't have enough lent money right now, and that's why there's this whole shadow banking system going on to create even more credit to keep the system going. I mean, it's rife with fraud because it's unregulated and it's not a good system, but you need credit. Credit is what makes the world go round. It's what runs economies. The producers have to pay their workers and materials before they have a product to sell, so before they have any money so they need an advance, so they have credit lines and they draw on their credit lines, pay workers and materials, then they sell the product and they pay off the advance. And that's the way the whole system works. So if you cut off that credit, which is basically banks issuing money they don't really have, but they're backing it with your promise to pay it back, then the whole system would collapse.
Okay, Rock, are you still there?
Yes, I'd like to. One other question. So that means that our nation is literally at the hands of the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve?
Yes, it is. But I think that's why I think we have to set up some public banks at a local level. First of all, we cannot pit ourselves against Wall Street. Wall Street is just way too big, it seems to me. I mean, maybe ideally you could get Glass-Steagall passed, and that would bring them down. And there's a bill for to reimpose Glass-Steagall, which separates investment banking from depository banking. That would bring down some very big banks if that were passed, but it would sort of wreak havoc in the meantime for those big banks to go down. That's why they're considered too big to fail. To me, the ideal way to fix the system is to just set up an alternative quietly. Set up a public banking system in your town. Have your city set up its own bank and move its revenues out of Wall Street into its own bank, leverage it into credit for the purposes of the community, and the interest goes back to the government, so then they can spend it on the things the government needs, and you have a sustainable system. And just do that locally, one town at a time or one state at a time or whatever. And then when you have this alternative set up, system set up, you can just move out of Wall Street. It's sort of a move your money, but move your public monies, move your government monies, which are really the big money. I mean, we individually don't even have much impact on Wall Street, even when we pull our money out. But when states pull their money out, that when California pulls its money out, that we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars that are in Wall Street banks, and they would feel that impact. But anyway, even, the idea is not necessarily to hurt Wall Street. It's just to set up a sustainable system that we can move into quietly, and we don't need Wall Street, and let them just go find some other work to do.
Okay. Now, you say all of this information is available on your website, the publicbankinginstitute.org. The book, if you haven't read it, Ellen's book, The Public Bank Solution, is extremely well written, and it really helped break it down for a person like myself who was hearing these big words and now telling us, no, we can't do this, we will destroy the economy, and literally a form of a psychic terror the way they present it to us. Now, I have another question. We're down to about 7 minutes or so. I have one another question from the audience, from Liz in Florida. What do you foresee if nothing is done regarding our present banking abuses and corruption? How long can the country continue? What would be the progression of a timeline of collapse if this isn't corrected? And as you said, could we even actually collapse?
I think they're in control. They're big interests up there that are pulling the strings. And if they decide they want to collapse the system, that's when it's going to collapse. But let's say that J.P. Morgan does something really foolish like the London Whale thing, and let's say it's much bigger, and so they will then bail in our deposits, because those systems are already in place. They've actually been told that that's what they're supposed to do, and so they'll even say, well, it's legal because the Financial Stability Board told us to do this, and we the G20 nations, with President Obama shook hands in London with the other G20 leaders, we agreed to be bound by their rules, and so we have to bail in your deposits, which means we'll take your deposits and turn them into our capital for our bank, as if you're our partners. In other words, you were investing in our bank. But of course, we didn't know we were investors. We thought the bank was there keeping our money safe. So I could well see that happening, and which means that let's say it was J.P. Morgan, everybody who's got a checking account at J.P. Morgan is going to be out of luck. That wouldn't necessarily bring down the system. I mean, certainly big banks have, such things have happened before where people have lost a lot of money, and it doesn't, like even say 1929, people lost a lot of money, but that didn't ruin the whole system. But what it will do is wake a lot of people up. At that point, I think everybody will say, that's not what I thought a bank was for. That's not the kind of bank I want. I'm not banking with them. That's when I think we'd actually set up a public banking system that would actually work. And there are models globally. That's what I just wrote about in Public Bank Solution. I was surprised myself when I looked, because they don't teach this stuff in school. They don't tell you that, well, China is actually, despite what people think, is actually very rich and is actually doing very well. And that they have a public banking system, and they own their own banks, and they fund whatever they want to fund. The government funds what it needs to fund. It funds the infrastructure. I mean, of course, they've done a lot of overbuilding that they don't need, but they put people to work doing it. It's a way of keeping everybody employed. So those countries that own their own banks are actually running circles around us, even though we don't hear much about it. Korea, Japan. Of course, the Middle Eastern ones, we're attacking them, so they're not doing so well right now. But I hope we don't think about attacking China because we're threatened by their banking system. Anyway, there are other great models out there, and we could do that too, but the people are just not awake. I mean, most people are so busy with their jobs, and they only have time to turn on the news for 5 minutes, and they think they know what's going on, and they don't even realize the threat is out there until it happens, and I think it probably will happen, maybe not too far in the future.
that and the information is framed to us in such a way, as I said, when I picked up your book, the words are so overwhelming, and we're told, you know, creating money is bad, inflationary, and so much misinformation. It's not just that they're not awake, but the information they are getting, when I compare it to what I read in your book, it's amazing that we're just frankly being lied to.
Yeah, I would agree.
So, and there was before we close up, I did want to point out, I don't know if you caught the gentleman in Spain being one of the countries that are being threatened with the buy-ins, that had been laid off from a mattress factory and set himself up producing his own mattresses with a digital safe in the headboard, or in the head of the mattress, literally keeping your money close when you... And he's actually doing quite well. So, for those of you who are listening to Ellen and don't really want to leave your money in the banks because they're looking to, well, but for a small, most of our listeners are not going to have large sums of money in the bank. Are those affecting the really small depositors, or are we talking people who are not, you know, above the FDIC limit?
Well, it's both. It depends. It's not the bank that's going to protect you. They're not going to give you back your money, even as a small depositor. It's the FDIC that's supposed to give you back their money. But the FDIC only has $25 billion in their fund. I think it's up a little now, maybe $30 billion, to cover something like $6 trillion in deposits. And if, say, J.P. Morgan or Bank of America, they both have over $1 trillion in deposits. If they have, if there's another $700 billion crisis like in 2008, the FDIC doesn't have enough money to cover those deposits. And under Dodd-Frank, the legislation says that the government is not going to be responsible, so they can't get it from the Treasury. Like before, they borrowed from the Treasury, and then the banks that are their members have had to pay it back. But they won't be able to do that this time. So you could well be out as a small depositor. I would agree that most people, I mean, I don't keep a lot of money in banks. Most people don't really keep their money in banks anymore. They keep it other places. But all those places aren't really safe. Like, if your money's in the stock market, and let's say you get nervous about what the stock market's doing, and you sell a bunch of stock, and you just have the money sitting there, and you think, well, it's safe. It's just sitting there. It's cash. I'm not going to lose it in this stock that's going down. But what they do with the cash is they put it in Wall Street overnight, in these overnight sweeps. So if, let's say they put it in J.P. Morgan and it went bankrupt overnight, which is when they always do go bankrupt. They don't do it during the day. Then
okay, Ellen, I hate to interrupt because this has been so informative, but I'm getting the red light flashed at me. I think I'm going to be contacting a guy in Spain. Again, this is our guest, Ellen Brown with the Public Banking Institute. You can go and get this information from her website, thepublicbankinginstitute.com or .org. Read her book, The Public Bank Solution. It was wonderful. This is Jeanette Lafee from The People Speak Radio. Y'all have a good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.